Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Today we have with us Dr. Heidi Kivo Feldman. She's an associate professor in the Department of Communication Studies at Northeastern University in Boston. She uses conversation analysis to examine interactions in organizational settings such as 911 emergency dispatch centers. She recently published a paper in the Annals of Emergency Dispatch and Response on active silent callers, and her current projects include finding best practices for emergency dispatchers to calm and instruct hysterical callers, as well as how negotiators and 911 dispatchers convince suicidal people to choose life. So welcome, Heidi.
Thank you.
Before we get into the study you published on active silent callers, let's talk for a moment about conversation analysis. For those who think of research as very quantitative and data-driven, it might seem like kind of an unusual approach. So could you explain what exactly conversation analysis is and how it might help us better understand the work of emergency dispatchers?
Right. So conversation analysis is a method of study that uses actual conversation as its primary source of data. So instead of collecting surveys or doing interviews, I analyze real talk, actual phone calls between dispatchers and callers. So what I do is I start by repeatedly viewing or listening to recorded data, and I create technical transcripts to see not just what's said, how it's said, when it's said, and all the features of talk that we use in our everyday lives to do things like ask people for help or give people instructions. And then I start to analyze the activities that make up a complete phone call. So like callers' requests, their complaints, caller hysteria, like I'm working on now. And then I look at things like turn design and how that activity might place some type of constraint on the ways that callers respond or the way that dispatchers then come to understand what callers are up to. So by analyzing the organization of conversation turn by turn, I can assess people's understanding within the actual interaction and then find patterns where we notice things like best practices and maybe not so best practices. But it's all based on what dispatchers actually do. So I don't come in and look at brand new things and say you're doing something wrong. I look at what dispatchers already do and I expose it for them to see how systematically the work they do is right, essentially.
And your recent study that you published in AEDR, you used that approach to look at how emergency dispatchers manage silent calls. And what was interesting to me about that study was that you were trying to find ways to differentiate between hang-ups and pocket dials and other kinds of what might be called sort of nuisance calls, as opposed to the very small number of silent calls that are real emergencies in which the person just isn't able to speak. So what made you take up that question? How did you come to that study?
Well, that came from the state police. My collaborator, Blair Sutherland, brought that problem to me. And he knew that I understand interaction and the patterns of interaction and what people are up to. And he said, well, can you help us figure out this problem? So that was something that they had struggled with, because anytime a dispatcher misses a potential active silent caller, it's a liability for them. And so what he wanted to do is figure out a way to increase the chances that dispatchers can catch the silent callers and help them.
And what are some of the situations in which one of these active silent calls might occur? What kinds of things might be happening?
Mostly domestic violence calls, I would say, if that's what you mean. We find that on occasion people might be held against their will, and because they're with their abuser, they're afraid to speak. So they try to call 911 for help, but they have to do it kind of on the sly. And because of the way cell phones are designed now, they're not the flip phone, they don't have any tactile feeling on the top of an iPhone, it's really difficult for them to respond quickly to prompts. So that's one situation and one challenge. Other situations include home invasions.
So you were talking about giving prompts or responding or giving ways for the caller to interact with the dispatcher other than by talking. And so it looked from your study like you identified something of a procedure that they use. Can you talk us through that?
Yes. So that's the Massachusetts has implemented a policy called the silent call procedure. And that procedure goes something like, if a caller does not verbally respond to a dispatcher's solicitations of 911, where is your emergency, and then hello, state police, then they would implement the silent call procedure by saying to the caller, if this is an emergency, press 1. So this is standard throughout the state of Massachusetts. I think other dispatch organizations use it, but I don't, to the best of my knowledge, I don't know if it's a policy anywhere else. And so once they do engage with the caller, then they have additional prompts. If you need fire, press 1, police, press 2, ambulance, press 3, and so on. The problem is that because dispatchers don't typically get responses from silent callers, there seems to be some struggle as to what to do once they have actually had them, once they made that connection. That's a study for another time.
So most of the time, in fact, a vast majority of the time when there's a silent call, it turns out to be a hang up or a pocket dial.
Right.
But then in those very few instances, when they do get a response, you're saying they have a hard time knowing what to follow up with because they didn't expect to get a response?
Well, it's not that they have a hard time. So from the dispatcher's perspective, because these callers are really the finding a needle in a haystack type of call, once they've engaged with them, they need to now find things like, what's your address? What's your exact address? If the person's in a house, they might be able to type in the numbers 123, and then the dispatcher could use their mapping technology to narrow down the street. But if they're in an apartment, then you have a whole other host of problems that they're not necessarily prepared for in terms of how to ask the questions and the kinds of prompts. So one thing I noticed in listening to the active silent callers, because of the way we are accustomed to speaking to people, they might say to a caller, are you on Main Street? But then they don't give the caller a prompt of yes or no, press 1 for yes, 2 for no. And they might forget something like that. So there needs to be more work in developing additional policies and protocols for how to continue the conversation past the press 1 if this is an emergency.
Another thing you found in that study was that there was a certain period of time that dispatchers should wait in order to get a response because it could take time, as you mentioned, for the caller to actually respond to the prompt. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, so that was the initial design. The problem with this study is how was I going to figure this out? This was a big puzzle. And so what I did was I shadowed dispatchers for about 4 months and I collected all calls. Every call they took, I collected, including the nuisance calls that they received. I also had a small collection of actual active silent calls as a comparison to what they normally get in during a regular work shift. So what I did was I timed all the silences. Silence is also another, we'll say, arsenal in our toolbox of interactional ways of communicating. So you could use silence to do certain types of actions, and we understand silence from somebody in a particular way. And so what struck me was that in ordinary everyday nuisance calls, the dispatchers would wait for an exceptionally long time for the caller to respond to verbal solicitations. And they would do multiple rounds of, hello, 911, hello, hello. And then go into if this is an emergency, press 1. What I found is that dispatchers would wait a very long time for the verbal response to their solicitation. But when it came to the if this is an emergency, press 1, it seemed that dispatchers would then start treating the call as one of those many nuisance calls, and they would wait maybe a second or two on average. As compared to the other group of calls that I had with the active silent call, it was systematic across the board that those active silent callers need a minimum of 4 seconds to respond to those prompts. So that's how I designed this study, and that's how I came up with that finding.
So once they give that prompt, they need to be waiting at least the 4 seconds to make sure that there's no one on the other end of the line.
Correct.
One thing you said there that I think is important is that silence is a form of communication, that's one of the tools that we can use in communicating with each other. Can you tell us more about how we can use silence effectively as a means of communication?
We use it all the time. If somebody, I always, say to people with silence, if you say to somebody, "Will you marry me?" and you count to 1 second of silence in your mind before you say yes, then that response might not seem authentic. And so we use silence in our ordinary interactions. Sometimes we can use it to persuade somebody to give a response, right? So if I ask you a question, if I wait long enough, you will respond. And I think that dispatchers instinctively understand that in their interactions with callers, because when somebody dials 911, presumably they know they're dialing 911, presumably they're calling for help. So if they do another solicitation, then they're trying to get them to speak, and they wait a long time because they, again, assume somebody's on the other line waiting, going to report some type of problem. So that's one way that people end up using silence. There are many, many studies on silence and interaction, including how long a normal amount of time is, an abnormal amount of time, and what silence communicates in different types of actions that we do, like inviting somebody or requesting something from somebody. So we see silence a lot.
I know also that our listeners will be very interested in the study you're doing around calming statements, because that's a critical component of emergency dispatch work. Where are you in that project, and what have you found that might be of use to dispatchers?
In that project is in its initial phases right now. I have a manuscript, a number of calls. Typically, from what I'm understanding in training, dispatchers are asked to do things like give callers directives like calm down, so that they can help them. But what I find in some of those calls is it occasionally works to calm somebody. But if a caller, and the first thing I was told when I worked with dispatchers is always think about the situation from the caller's perspective. So if a mother is looking at her child who just overdosed on drugs and he's now turning blue, she might not just simply say, "Okay, I'll calm down. What should I do?" There's a lot more. And what ends up happening is a problem of how does that dispatcher then get that caller to cooperate so that they can instruct them on giving CPR if that's what's necessary. So one thing I've noticed is that when dispatchers do things like, ma'am, calm down, it takes time away from the actual progression of the call, getting the dispatcher to be able to help that caller. But when dispatchers say things like, "Can you tell me if he's breathing?" Now, that's a type of question that requires a response that a caller can only give after they've done some inspection. So it initiates a move towards doing something. And if you could get callers to do something in the service of helping that person, I find, at least from my preliminary observations, that's much more successful than the calm down.
So driving the caller to actually take some action forces them out of their emotional state to some extent to do something to help the person.
Correct. And then it seems that dispatchers are very easily able to transition into the CPR protocol. I'm going to tell you exactly what to do. And then it just goes from there.
And that sounds like it would be similar to what you're studying with the suicidal callers, which is definitely a subject that a lot of dispatchers would like to know more about, because when we get suicidal callers on the line, the dispatchers are told to keep them on the line.
Right.
Because they want to talk to them. They don't want them to hang up and go do something else while they're waiting for the paramedics to arrive or the police or whoever's coming. And so a lot of dispatchers ask us, okay, once I've got them on the line and I've asked the questions, I've followed the protocol, then what? What do I say to them? And is that kind of what you're looking at?
Yes. And I'm working with people in the UK right now. We're collaborating on a project. So they have British calls where negotiators are speaking with people who are up on the roof or about to hang themselves. I have a collection of calls where 911 dispatchers are talking to somebody whose feet are dangling over the side of the bridge, or people who call and they report they're feeling suicidal. Occasionally, though, the one problem that dispatchers might run into is the person sitting on the side of the bridge might be afraid that the police will come and they will be in trouble for being there and creating a spectacle or what have you. And right now, what we're noticing is that dispatchers have a way of using what the callers have already provided as a form of logic that they cannot refute. So in other words, a caller might say, you know, my girlfriend's having my baby and, you know, I'm really depressed and this and that. The dispatcher then might say, well, you're going to be a father. That's so important. That's really great. And what we've noticed when they present something like that, because suicidal people want to, oddly enough, come across as very rational in their decision-making to commit suicide, they won't typically argue against the logic of something like that. So we call these things productive challenges, and we really just need more cases to show how they systematically work in the course of the interaction, what they might look like, what a dispatcher could possibly say. And the case I'm working on, the dispatcher is able to get the caller off the bridge. And in fact, that dispatcher won the Dispatcher of the Year award in the state of Massachusetts for that call.
That's very interesting. Anything that you're thinking about going forward in terms of using conversation analysis at the 911 center?
Oh, yes. Well, what I like to do typically is ask the dispatch supervisors and dispatchers themselves, what are the communication problems they seem to face when they talk to callers? And then I look in my database of calls and I try to come up with those instances that they talked about. I could easily go in and look at interaction and find linguistic features that might seem easy, but I'm more interested in trying to find communication problems that I could provide solutions for based on what dispatchers do that seem to work well for the interactions. I think that any of these calls, there's a single goal of getting help, sending help, helping these callers in one way or another. From every dispatcher I spoke to, that is something they take very seriously. And they all seem to have their own idea of what works best and what doesn't. And I feel like I can be that outlet for them to talk to so that I can collect these calls and then share their best practices with other people. But there are a million things to look at in these calls, and probably a lot of things that I haven't even noticed yet.
When you're talking to the dispatchers and you're asking them or their supervisors what their major issues are, what do you hear most often? What are the biggest challenge areas?
People don't know where they are, so location is always a problem. In the dispatch centers that I work with, the first question, where is your emergency, doesn't always get picked up as a where, so callers will immediately say what, and then the address might get lost in the shuffle. They also just legitimately don't know where they are in the world, on the highway, east, west, north, south, and they make a lot of assumptions about what dispatchers know, and that could be a point of frustration. So I like to look at cases where dispatchers can work through that frustration and maybe help callers articulate things in a better and a more concise way, in a timely way. It could also be the way that the outgoing messages are designed. So instead of where is your emergency, what is the exact location of your emergency, changes up how the caller might hear what they're being asked as a first thing. And then that might change the kind of response. I noticed that with some dispatchers, they do that. So when you shift around a little, you know, there's, you know, one method would be to do an analysis and kind of count how many times they use a certain word. What I like to do is look at a place in the interaction where you're initiating some kind of request, right? You're asking somebody for something. And then look at all the different ways, the variations that people have for asking. Even though things are scripted, you always have differences between inflection or if someone's using the present versus the past versus the future tense. There are always a number of variations. And as a result, there are a number of varying responses to things like that.
Well, before we go, I have one more question I'd like to explore, which is the question of qualitative research. So quantitative research is what people mostly think of when they think of scientific research, measuring things and evaluating them using numbers and statistics. Right. But qualitative research is different. It really is more interested in understanding the meaning or the context of events. It's sometimes described as more subjective. Could you tell us why you chose a qualitative approach and why it adds value to the research in emergency dispatching?
I think the primary question that I had as a researcher is really understanding what are people up to? How do people come to understand what other people are doing? What are the procedures or mechanisms that we have in interaction to get people to do the things that we want? I think the bottom line with any kind of work is, especially in the dispatch work, because you're dealing with people, because it is so incredibly serious, you could start to notice things, not just about the interaction, but also about the organization, the types of constraints that dispatchers have. And so while you might be looking at one little tiny small thing, it's operating within a much bigger picture. So I look at it like a ground up approach rather than say the more like, you know, the statistics and the outcome can give a nice big overview and picture of what's going on. And conversation analysis kind of offers that micro analysis explanation for how come. And even though I'm working with very small samples and people might think it's subjective, my data is available for everybody's inspection. And anybody can, if the analysis is good, anybody can walk away with their own conclusion of how something worked, why it worked that way, and how you can then go and apply it. So I think that for me, because of where my curiosity is, and I like watching people, understanding people, and trying to find and fix communication problems, the qualitative route was the best way for me to go.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardette. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.